Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence and whose expertise in the business of intelligence, as well as his patriotism, his service to our country in numerous capacities, and his role these days as the senior vice president of the Center for Security Policy for Policy and Programs, Fred Flights, is, well, that is very greatly appreciated, as is his time. He's giving us a full hour to discuss, among other things, his brand new book, Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud. Fred, congratulations on the book. Thank you for your time, and welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Well, Frank, thank you so much for that kind introduction. I'm also so grateful for your friendship and for your support with this important project.
Well, it is an important project. Frankly, you have really emerged as one of the country's preeminent authorities on this so-called nuclear deal with Iran, and I'm anxious to plumb what you have found and now pull together in this new book, Obama Bomb. Fred, maybe we could start just by recapping the nature of this deal. In the roughly 40 years I've been involved in national security policy issues, I've never seen anything like this, remotely like this. Talk about the nature of the deal itself, as you understand it.
Well, Obama Bomb tries to address that question because this is an agreement that purports to stop Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons, but really doesn't. The president said when he campaigned he was going to stop Iran's enrichment program. He was going to let Iran enrich plutonium. He would make Iran give up a heavy water reactor and a heavily fortified enrichment facility built inside of a mountain. But this is an agreement that lets Iran keep its entire nuclear infrastructure. It's allowed to continue enriching uranium. It's allowed to continue to build advanced centrifuges, which means in the future it will have smaller and more efficient enrichment facilities that we're never going to find with our spy satellites. And at the end of the day, this comes down to how could the president agree to an agreement like this? And I think the answer is he didn't want to stop Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons. He thought this would somehow make Iran a partner for peace in the Middle East. And I think it is motivated by some very radical ideologies by the president and, frankly, sheer incompetence.
Let's get into all of that. But I think I did want to start with just the most extraordinary piece of this, and that is that it's not even a deal. That they're calling it a political understanding. And I just explain to us, Fred Flights, what is meant by that, and more to the point, what, as a result, this deal is not.
Well, this is a great question. It's not a treaty, it was not signed, and it's not binding. Now, why was that? Because the U.S. had to make such extraordinary one-sided concessions to get this agreement. The administration realized it would never be ratified by the Senate. So it was negotiated as this non-treaty that could be forced through over the objections of both houses of Congress. And I might point out, the top Democrats on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee both voted against this, which is extraordinary. This wasn't just right-wing Republicans against this agreement. It was basically negotiated to do an end run around the constitutional provisions on the ratification of treaties because the president knew the American people would never accept this agreement.
They nonetheless were induced to go along with it, I guess is the best way to describe it. notwithstanding the kinds of problems that you've alluded to, Fred, and we'll talk about them in detail. But the way in which that was done was also quite extraordinary. Remind us how the Congress wound up allowing this deal to become binding. You say it's not binding, but it certainly is binding on us, as best as I can tell, through a mechanism very different from what the founders of this republic had in mind for the Senate of the United States.
Well, a process was passed by a bill called the Corker-Cardin Act, which, according to our friend Andy McCarthy, turned the Constitution on its head because it required Congress to pass a resolution of disapproval by veto-proof and filibuster-proof majorities to kill the deal. And that meant that the president only needed to get one-third plus one in either house to support the deal. This is not, obviously, this is not the way major agreements like this are supposed to go. When two-thirds of, almost two-thirds of either house of Congress can be opposed and it still goes through, it was a bad idea, and it allows the president to say that his agreement was approved by Congress or survived congressional review. Well, I guess it did survive congressional review, but the process that was set up to do that, I think, really made a mockery of the Constitution.
Well, it did. It subverted the Constitution because specifically, having had the privilege of serving in the United States Senate, I can tell you that the idea of the Senate as a quality control mechanism on treaties, which, again, the framers understood could be used not just to effectively change the Constitution, but subvert it and the national security to boot. And I think as a result, they wanted a very high bar. What we got in this arrangement was a very low bar. And so let's turn to some of those particulars that you mentioned, Fred, that are now part of this arrangement, this understanding with the Iranians, and that are so worrying. The president and his supporters has made much of the fact that for 10 years at least, Iran will not be able to obtain nuclear weapons. You have found in your book, Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud, that's not true. Tell us about that.
Well, it's everything about this agreement is full of false and misleading statements, and that's the most important one. The president claimed that this agreement will keep Iran at least a year away from a nuclear bomb for 10 years. But in fact, the timeline will shorten throughout the deal because Iran will be allowed to continue to improve its expertise in enriching uranium and to develop advanced centrifuges. Now, that's the uranium route to a nuclear weapon. We found out something else, working with some people who I know looking over this agreement concerning the plutonium route. The administration claimed that a heavy water reactor near the city of Arak, that's spelled A-R-A-K, closes off the plutonium route because this reactor will be redesigned so it does not produce plutonium. Other than the fact that that's physically impossible for a heavy water reactor not to produce plutonium, the Arms Control Association, which is certainly not an ally of conservative groups who hate the deal, it was promoting the deal, has found that when we design this reactor, we'll produce a quarter of a nuclear weapons worth of plutonium every year. Unless Iran redesigned it, in which case it will produce half of a nuclear weapons worth of plutonium every year. But Frank, it gets worse. China is redesigning this reactor, and it has been exempted from an oversight process in the nuclear agreement that requires sensitive nuclear technology to be approved by the parties to the agreement. So I think, you know, there are a lot of troublesome developments here that we're just finding out about.
Fred, we're going to pause in a moment, but I just wanted to say that what you've detailed just in those few, you know, examples is on its face outrageous. And I'm sorry to say that it gets worse the deeper you drill into this thing, as you have done in your new book, Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud. And we'll talk more about For example, the complete fraud that is now the verification regimen, for example, and the secret side deals that the Congress was not exposed to, and some of which are still now, just in the past few days, coming to light. And what all of this means, particularly to a career intelligence professional like Fred Flights, and what it could mean to you. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Flights with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Flights. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're visiting with my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our senior vice president, Fred Flights, the author of a new book entitled Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud. And Fred, I know you have used that term advisedly, fraud, to describe the Obama bomb, I guess the sort of functional counterpart to the Obamacare disaster that he wrought in healthcare. This disaster is made the worse because among the many details of this agreement that are problematic and likely to be violated, if not already being violated, there is an overarching problem with the verification of the terms of this agreement. This has largely been contracted out to a group called the International Atomic Energy Agency. And talk about this group and the role that it's playing and what we're finding out about the limits on that role.
Well, the President and Secretary Kerry have said that this agreement has the strongest verification for any arms control agreement in history and touches every element of Iran's nuclear program. The truth is, it only addresses the declared Iranian nuclear program and declared supply chain. There's a convoluted process to get access to non-declared sites, but for a variety of reasons, it's never going to be used, and the administration just won't talk about this. Iran said it will walk. It will back out of the agreement if there are sanctions put up against it, if it doesn't comply for these agreements. Sanctions are supposed to snap back. Sanctions can't snap back unless it is a significant violation. You can imagine the parties to the agreement arguing about that. And in addition, any intelligence on a suspect facility has to be shared with all parties. Now, we're not going to want to do that with the Iranians, the Chinese, and the Russians. But even if we did, this intelligence is rarely conclusive. So there's a lot here that really makes the verification provisions much weaker than we've been told.
We're talking with Fred Flights about the unverifiability of this so-called Iran nuclear deal. And Fred, you were among those who helped two important members of Congress, Senator Tom Cotton and Congressman Mike Pompeo, expose the reality of some very serious limitations on what the IAEA can do. You mentioned that there's a distinction drawn between declared sites and non-declared, that is to say, covert sites. In practice, as a guy who spent most of your adult life working these kinds of problems from an intelligence collection and analysis perspective with respect to rogue states and their proliferation programs, give us a net assessment of what it means that the terms are so restrictive for the IAEA and especially those of these side deals.
Well, there's an even more disturbing aspect of the verification part of this agreement, and that is the fact that Iran has placed military facilities off limits to inspectors. And we saw that in a secret side deal discovered by Senator Tom Cotton and Congressman Mike Pompeo after the agreement was announced last July, in which, in this side deal, Iranians were it said Iranians would be used to investigate facilities where Iran allegedly had been engaged in nuclear weapons-related activities. And so basically, this is a violation of the way the intelligence community always has these inspections done. You can't let a party to a dispute collect its own samples. So there were senators who said this is like an NFL player mailing in his own urine samples as part of a drug testing investigation. It really leads to results that the international community can't trust. Now, we don't know the extent that that's being done. I think it's fairly extensive. But I might add that even though Iranians investigated a particular facility called Parchin, where testing related to the development of nuclear warheads was conducted, the IAEA still found, even though there were efforts to conceal activities at this facility and repainting it and removing soil, still found indications that nuclear weapons work had been conducted there. So the verification is bad, and Iran is trying to subvert it. But even with those efforts, there's still been evidence in nuclear weapons-related work discovered.
And this leads to the point. My old boss, Dr. Freddie Clay, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the Reagan administration, famously wrote an article for Foreign Affairs magazine entitled, "After Detection, What?" And this is the problem, of course. As you said earlier, the limitations on the access that the inspectors might have, the reliance on international inspectors at that, the degree to which the Iranians themselves get to make the call on what we can see and what we can know, and most particularly, perhaps, Fred, the fact that the intelligence may be so sensitive, if we do get it, that we can't use it. You get into a situation where, even if there is detection, as at Parchin, nothing comes of it. Isn't that right?
I think that's right. And I think that Clay would have told you that when an arms control inspection takes place, the inspectors go in with their equipment, the equipment of their choice, and they go anywhere they want. When Parchin was inspected, Iranians inspected a handful of carefully selected sites. And it was, as I said, being done by Iranian citizens with Iranian equipment. It was an outrage.
And this is Fred, was this not the site that the Iranians had also gone to extraordinary lengths to clean up, that they'd been removing topsoil and otherwise trying to ensure there were no signatures there?
Yes, and I talk about in the book that there are reports by a number of outside groups, including the Institute for Science and International Security, that said we may never know what really happened at Parchin because the Iranians removed so much evidence and soil samples. They washed down buildings. They painted and refurbished the inside of buildings where nuclear-related activities reportedly took place. We may never know what happened there. And I wonder, I think a variety of WMD activities happened there, probably nuclear, maybe chemical, maybe biological.
It certainly seems likely there. And the trouble is, Fred Flights, as you understand so well, is that we have no idea how many other places in Iran similar kind of work is going on, or at least other kinds of covert nuclear programs are taking place, all off limits, effectively, to our inspection. Fred, let me ask you about one other piece of this. There's so many different dimensions of this fraud and the danger that it represents, but one that just struck me, and you referred to this in, I believe, two presentations you made on this issue, marking the anniversary of this disaster, one at the Endowment for Middle East Truth and the other at the Heritage Foundation last week, namely the discrepancy, the rather extraordinary discrepancy between the lengths of the documents that were presented to the Congress on the one hand in English and to the Iranian Majlis or Parliament in Farsi. Has anybody explained what is in the Iranian document that makes it 10 times longer than the one that Congress was asked to focus on? And more to the point, what differences are in those two documents?
This is another element of this fraud that the Obama administration, European states, and the IAEA has ignored. Last October, the Iranian parliament passed an alternate version of this agreement that says the agreement should focus on Israel's nuclear program, says sanctions are terminated, not suspended, and place military facilities off limits. And that's what we know of from the English version. We don't know what's in the Persian version. I don't know anyone who's translated. I've been in touch with a number of groups. And I mean, the administration said that Iran was going to approve and back this agreement, but there was nothing said about Iran approving an alternate version of the agreement that significantly weakened it.
Fred, hold on. We're going to come back to this with more. And Fred Flights, author of Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan once described democracy as a bus you disembark upon reaching your destination. Erdogan is now forcing his country out of the bus. In the aftermath of a short-lived and hapless coup attempt, he has declared a 3-month state of emergency, facilitating his purge of political opponents and consolidation of power. It will also help Erdogan complete his fundamental transformation of Turkey from a secular Muslim nation into a Sharia-adherent and brutally repressive Islamic caliphate. One of those political opponents is Fethullah Gulen, another Turkish Islamist who runs a global cult and business empire from an armed camp in Pennsylvania's Pocono Mountains. Erdogan wants him extradited on the grounds that Gulen was behind the coup. Washington is investigating those charges. It should also investigate and shut down Gulen's 150-plus problematic charter schools in this country. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Fred Flights is our guest for this full hour of conversation about the Obama bomb and more. Fred is one of the country's preeminent experts on these subjects, having served for some 20 years in the Central Intelligence Agency as an analyst monitoring and trying to make sense of what various rogue states, including Iran and North Korea, were doing with respect to their nuclear ambitions. He's now contributing mightily to the understanding of those of us in the unclassified domain through his writings at National Review Online and Newsmax, his appearances at Fox, and of course in his work at the Center for Security Policy, where he is a senior vice president. He is the author of Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud. And Fred, I just wanted to make one point based on my own experience negotiating arms control agreements with the Soviet Union a long time ago. The detailed effort made to assure that verification measures would pass muster with a Congress that would be skeptical, a Senate specifically that had to give a 2-thirds majority to approve a treaty, was accompanied inevitably by a very exacting effort made to assure the conformity, as they called it, of the two sides' versions of the document. And a lot of time was spent getting the translations right, making sure that they said the same thing in English and in Russian and so on. Again, this is such an affront to any kind of rigorous, professional negotiation, let alone, the product being other than simply a fraud on the American people, isn't it?
Well, this was not a serious effort to stop Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons, but let me add something that will upset you even more. The agreement specifically says that the Iranian parliament will ratify this agreement, but does not give the U.S. Congress the same right. I think that's extremely significant.
It is. Again, another example of the one-sided nature of this agreement. Fred, one of the things that has come about in the aftermath of this deal is that, as they say, the books have been closed on an aspect of the Iranian nuclear program that was particularly worrying. Talk a bit about that, if you would.
This is, I think, the most important aspect of the deal, and I spent a lot of time discussing this in Obama-bomb. The issue of the possible military dimensions of Iran's nuclear program, which is IAEA lingo for Iran's past nuclear weapons-related work, it's essential that that be resolved to verify an agreement on Iran's nuclear program. The inspectors have to know what to look for, where to go. Iran wanted this issue closed. They wanted the file on this issue closed. And that's what happened. Even though the IAEA issued a report last December that found Iran's nuclear weapons program continued at least until 2009. And from my analysis and the analysis of others, including the Institute for Science and International Security and Ali Hanonen, a former IAEA inspector, it seems clear to us that we have no way of knowing whether Iran's nuclear weapons effort ever ceased. Despite that, the administration voted with other states unanimously last December to close the books on this issue, which I just is outrageous. This isn't a serious agreement, and we can't verify something if the inspectors don't know what the Iranians were up to.
Fred, talk a bit, if you would, about the concessions that have been made since all of that, notably the efforts that John Kerry, the Secretary of State, has been making to try to essentially enable Iran to gain access to international commerce and markets and even the dollar-denominated ones completely outside of this this agreement. I mean, it's a level of advocacy that I know was in evidence before the deal was finished, but it's taken it to a new and, I think, really obscene level, hasn't it?
Well, the concessions we knew about when Congress voted on the deal last September were significant, conceding Iran's nuclear program, lifting sanctions against Iranian terrorists. But we've learned of more concessions since then. One of them was dumbing down IAEA reporting so the details of Iran's nuclear program isn't available to the public or the U.S. Congress. This is big. But even more recently, Congress has found that the administration is trying to give Iran access to the U.S. financial system and dollarize transactions because the Iranian government says that the deal was not generous enough to Iran. And there's some journals are saying that the Iranian government is blackmailing this administration by threatening to walk out on the president's legacy nuclear agreement if it doesn't come forward with more concession.
I was struck, Fred Flights, by the fact that the word got out after the agreement was done that the administration had really served in the negotiating process as Iran's advocates to the other parties, the PERM 5 plus 1, as it's called. And that seems to be something they're doing even more of now. And I gather the Treasury Department is not altogether happy with this level of advocacy and accommodation led by Secretary Kerry. Is that right?
It's interesting that the Treasury Department actually tried to implement sanctions against Iran last December for its missile test. I think that they must not have been discussing what they were doing with the rest of the administration, because a few days later that was canceled. But what you said is exactly right. This administration has been accused of being Iran's global lobbying shop for promoting business in Iran with companies in the U.S. and in Europe. And we know Airbus and Boeing have responded to this with huge deals with Iran to sell Iran civilian aircraft that will probably be used to ferry terrorists to Lebanon and Syria.
Well, or worldwide, for that matter, given the capacity that they would have for long-distance travel as well. Fred Flights, let me ask you, there are two other pieces of this that I'd like to make sure we cover before we move on to a couple of other topics that I want to address with you before we run out of time. One is the evidence that Iran's been emboldened by this, well, submission is the term that comes to my mind in the tradition of the Sharia adherent Muslims that govern Iran. When you look at the Iranian conduct since the agreement with respect to its ongoing support for terrorist organizations like Hezbollah, for example, its efforts at obtaining essentially regional hegemony in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria, and of course Lebanon, its handling of even American hostages that it seized. You and I met yesterday with Pastor Saeed Abedini, one of those that was held completely groundlessly by the Iranians until fairly recently. Give us a sense of how, as an intelligence professional, you would look at the effects of all of these acts of appeasement and accommodation on Iranian behavior.
Well, it's very troubling because the administration said that this agreement marked a new era of cooperation between the U.S. and Iran and led us to believe that Iran's behavior would improve after the deal was announced. I'm not going to say it was signed because you and I know it wasn't signed. But the behavior of Iran has gotten significantly worse since the agreement. Now, you mentioned that there are 10 U.S. sailors who were briefly taken prisoner and mistreated last January. There's been ballistic missile tests. Rockets were fired near an aircraft carrier in December. Iran threatened to close the Strait of Hormuz. It's increased its support to the Assad regime. It's been accused on several occasions of arming the Taliban. Boatloads of weapons have been intercepted en route to the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And I think most significantly, Iran pledged $70 million to the Palestinian terrorist group Islamic Jihad earlier this year to conduct jihad against Israel. And make no mistake, that $70 million came from the $150 billion in sanctions relief that Iran received in January.
Fred Flights, we have to pause for a moment. We'll be right back with more with the author of Obama Bomb, a dangerous and growing national security fraud. You can check it out for free online at securefreedom.org. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are once again joined by Fred Flights, the Senior Vice President of the Center for Security Policy for Policy and Programs. He is the author, among many other works, of Obama Bomb, a dangerous and growing national security fraud. We've been talking about this fraud and what it portends for all of us. Fred, one of the most recent developments, interestingly enough, again at the hands of the Treasury, and I'm not sure whether this was coordinated with the rest of the government or not and whether it will remain the case, but Treasury has sanctioned three individuals associated with Al-Qaeda who it says are operating with impunity from Iran. Now, I just ask you, we're endlessly told that the Sunnis don't get along with the Shia, and in particular that Iran is, of course, operating against Al-Qaeda elements in Syria as we speak. For that matter, the Al-Qaeda offshoot, the Islamic State in Iraq. What's going on here? Tell us about the sanctions, first of all, and explain, if you can, this seeming disconnect.
Well, it looks like a disconnect, and the administration and supporters frequently say that Iran can be our ally to fight al-Qaeda because they hate al-Qaeda too, and they're at war with al-Qaeda. But this is not the first instance of al-Qaeda operatives operating out of Tehran. The administration sanctioned a group of al-Qaeda operatives operating out of Iran, I think in 2010, for similar terrorist activities. And 3 years ago, there was a plot to blow up a train en route from Toronto to New York that was sponsored by an al-Qaeda group operating out of Tehran. And I think this simply goes to the old adage, which is pretty common among these terrorist groups, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And there have been a number of instances of this collaboration and claims by the administration, the liberal foreign policy establishment, that Iran does not cooperate with al-Qaeda is just dead wrong.
It also calls to mind, Fred, something that our colleague Claire Lopez talked about with me earlier this week, namely the collaboration between the Iranians and the Saudis, who are supposed to be mortal enemies of one another, again, for the purpose of engaging in acts of jihad against us, specifically collaboration in the run-up to and apparently the execution of the 9/11 attacks. We've recently had these 28 pages come out, talk a lot about the Saudis and some of their very, very unacceptable behavior with respect to the jihad. But there wasn't any reference made that I recall about Iran. Can you help us sort this as well?
Well, the 28 pages, I think, leaves the Saudi government with a lot to answer for concerning its active collaboration with al-Qaeda groups. And I don't know that it was high-level members of the government. There clearly were some levels of the government and prominent Saudis who were collaborating or supporting al-Qaeda before the 9/11 attacks. And there's a reference to this in the 9/11 Commission report, but for some reason this was classified and kept out of the congressional report on the 9/11 attacks. And I think that the Saudis have to be held accountable for this, and Saudi officials or senior businessmen who were involved in this, I think we have to hold them accountable.
One of the explanations for why this happened, this excision until now, 15 years later, of this congressional report, is what has come to be called willful blindness on the part of the United States government with respect to a lot of this Islamist activity and indeed the wellspring of much of it, the House of Saud. And Fred Flights, again, as an intelligence professional, I know you've been following closely this whole question of what has been done to our first lines of defense to essentially render them blind to much of the threat that we're facing now from Islamic supremacism. This is, of course, the subject of the new book that Claire Lopez, one of our other colleagues, as I mentioned, and I have recently written, See No Sharia, again, available for free at securefreedom.org. Fred, as a guy who spent most of his life in the intelligence community, what does this mean? This kind of blindness, this disarming, if you will, of our first lines of defense in a very practical way for the safety of the American people?
Well, looking at it from an intelligence officer, I think intelligence analysts, intelligence collectors have their hands tied behind their back because they're not allowed to focus on the real nature of the threat. They're not allowed to use certain terms like jihad and jihadist and Islamist, radical Islam, the global jihad movement. And they're basically, you know, we can't defeat a threat that we refuse to recognize or acknowledge. And we know that the Department of Homeland Security recently issued an order banning its employees from using most of these terms. And I'm just thinking, if we don't allow our intelligence analysts and operatives to basically go where the evidence leads and to call things honestly, our national security is at great risk.
One other aspect of that, Fred, and this may be more of a domestic issue at the moment, but it certainly has its international counterparts, and that is a problem that I think of as kind of the infrastructure for jihad that has been built here through the work of the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamic supremacists. It's often called sort of nonviolent dawah or proselytization and the like, but it really is, I think, better described as pre-violent behavior. And based on what you know, Fred, of these attacks that have been conducted in various parts of Europe and now in some number here as well, and their connections to mosques that are associated with one brand or another of this sort of Islamist ideology of Sharia, how serious a problem do you regard that to be, and what should we be doing about it?
I think it is a very serious problem, and as our friend Dr. Zuki Jasser has said, that when we have imams in this country who are preaching hate and hatred of the United States, they are serving as the incubators for radicalization. They claim they condemn terrorism. They come out after bombings and attacks such as San Bernardino and Nice and Orlando and say they're against violence. But in their mosques, they are preaching hate. They are encouraging jihadists. They are encouraging young jihadists to emerge from their mosque, even if they don't actually tell them to engage in violence. And this is something that we really have to take a stand on, and that's not being focused on in our law enforcement community. It's not being looked at by our intelligence agencies.
Yeah, well, it's at this point, as you know better than I think a career-ending offense to take these things on. And Fred, just quickly, is it your view, based on what you know of the Muslim Brotherhood, that the effort being made by Senator Cruz in the Senate and Mario Diaz-Balart in the House, among others, to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization is a necessary corrective as well?
It is essential, because the Muslim Brotherhood is promoting violent and pre-violent jihad to promote Sharia worldwide. And Senator Cruz has it exactly right in trying to finally designate this organization as a terrorist organization. I hope you succeed.
Yeah, I hope so as well. Fred, we have to pause for one more minute. When we come back, I want to talk with you about Mrs. Clinton's emails, which have been getting a lot of attention at the Republican National Convention this week, among other places. Sadly, not from the Department of Justice, it would appear, but also another of your new books on China, Warning Order. That and much more with Fred Flights at the Center for Security Policy right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're in the final segment of our very, very thought-provoking and timely conversation with one of the best intelligence professionals and, well, for that matter, national security professionals I know, Fred Flights. Now, I'm very pleased to say, a senior vice president at the Center for Security Policy, the author of a book we've been discussing throughout the program, Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud. And Fred, speaking of national security frauds, let me ask you about Hillary Clinton's emails. They've been the subject of course, a lot of criticism, and rightly so, in the wake of the FBI director's decision that he couldn't get anybody at the Justice Department to prosecute her for violations of federal law. I'd like to get your thoughts on how serious those violations were and whether we've now established at the minimum through Trey Gowdy's line of questioning to Director Comey that there's a case for perjury against Hillary, if nothing else.
So let's talk about how serious they are in two ways. First of all, the FBI director said that her email system was extremely careless. You know, you and I would be in jail if we did this. And we could go over the particulars, but having this private email server that was completely unsecure, being run outside of the protections of the U.S. government and IT professionals, was just outrageous. But an issue as an intelligence officer I found even more significant was Comey all but said that foreign intelligence services, hostile intelligence services, acquired Mrs. Clinton's emails because she used electronic communication devices in countries like China and other countries where there are hostile intelligence services. He didn't name China, but he said she used these devices with her hostile intelligence services. This is just outrageous. It's incredible that this woman felt that she was not just above the law, but she was above regulations that are in place to protect our freedom by not compromising crucial secrets. This could have been on terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, who knows? But I mean, it was an incredible violation of her responsibilities as a senior U.S. official.
And as you know, Fred Flights, as a former senior official yourself in the Department of State, as the chief of staff to Ambassador John Bolton during the Bush administration, that some of these were regulations that she herself promulgated and, in fact, punished others for violating in their own capacities. I mean, it is outrageous on so many different levels. But just turn to that question of whether or not you think there's a basis for perjury charges to be brought against her, given the lies she told the Congress that have now been shown to be lies by Director Comey's agency.
Well, she said when she testified before the Benghazi committee that she never sent classified emails on her personal communication devices, and she made other statements like that. FBI Director Comey made clear that that's not true. When he gave his press conference recently on the outcome of his investigation of the email scandal. So that's
yeah, and then Congressman Trey Gowdy went through this sort of point by point with him the other day in congressional testimony as well. And certainly seems to me it's established a basis for action by the Congress and by the FBI. I hope they'll take it up. Fred, let me turn to one other very important contribution you've made to the work of the Center for Security Policy recently, and that is you edited an important compendium of essays called Warning Order. Tell us a bit about that book and its important conclusions.
Well, this book, Warning Order, China Prepares for Conflict and Why We Must Do the Same, talks about how China is preparing for conflict with the United States in the military sphere, diplomatic sphere, economic sphere, cyber sphere, espionage sphere, and we are simply not prepared for it. And it goes beyond simply China's recent efforts to seize control of almost the entire South China Sea. According to Kevin Freeman, who wrote an excellent chapter in this book, China is preparing efforts to possibly crash the U.S. stock market in economic warfare against the United States. So our contributors, which include Gordon Chang and Kevin Freeman, Bill Gertz, Admiral Ace Lyons, and Senator Jim Talent, I think we put together a group of essays that has a pretty chilling message for Americans on our national security.
Indeed. You know, it comes as reports in Defense News yesterday indicated that the Chief of Naval Operations, America's top naval officer, has indicated he's willing to continue so-called mil-mil, military-military, in this case Navy-Navy exchanges and joint exercises with the Chinese, but not as long as they engage in dangerous and certainly provocative behavior towards our ships and aircraft. This would seem to be a message that should have been communicated a long time ago and far more forcefully, Fred Flights, given what you've documented in Warning Order in terms of the comprehensive and increasingly aggressive actions of the Chinese in the South China Sea and elsewhere, very much at odds with our interests and those of our allies.
And then there's the theft of trade secrets, the theft of defense secrets, that Chinese aircraft and other military equipment is being built with secrets that the U.S. taxpayer spent billions of dollars to develop. There's so much to this, and the U.S. government is simply doing almost nothing to counter it.
Or even, I think, to accurately depict what's going on and raise public awareness of it, which would be important, if not essential, to the kind of corrective actions that that you and your colleagues are calling for. Fred, let me ask you about one other thing. In the aftermath of the recent ruling by this International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea Treaty that essentially gave the Philippines the full backing to oppose China's assertion of sovereignty over the South China Sea and its manufacturing of these islands and arming them and so on. Vice President Joe Biden has been traveling in the region. There is, I guess, if there's any silver lining to all of this, a growing sense of concern on the part of a lot of nations out there and a desire to work with us, including, evidently, now the New Zealanders agreeing to essentially relent on a position they've taken for some 30 years, precluding U.S. naval vessels from visiting their ports. Just as at the macro level, because we're almost out of time, what's your sense of how things are shaping up? Are we likely to see these allies come together in a meaningful enough way that will deter conflict with China, or must we do more?
I don't think that will happen under this administration, but it is very worrisome that China's trying to seize this entire area. But China said that it disregards this ruling as valid, and it's going to continue trying to seize this territory.
And does the fact that the Kiwis have decided that they'll relent and let us bring ships into their ports augur a significant counterweight to the Chinese, or is this not very much about not very much?
It's a promising development, and we've seen other promising developments from Indonesia and especially the Philippines, which desperately wants the U.S. back. And, maybe we will have U.S. ships back in Subic Bay sometime soon. That would make a big difference.
Well, I know that's underway. The question is, do we get there in time to have the Scarborough Shoal, which is essentially at the mouth of Subic Bay, taken over by the Chinese and used as a means of neutralizing any use we might make of Subic? Very interesting times, it goes without saying. Fred, few people do as good a job of addressing these various issues, and we're very proud to have you doing it with us at the Center for Security Policy. I thank you for that work, as well as that you do at National Review Online and Newsmax and Fox and so many other outlets. Please do keep it up and come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.